Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I am Pranay and I have with me Anupam. And Anupam, last week was not exactly the most glorious week for the banking sector in India. We had two things happening. One was this entire Yes Bank crisis and the eventual takeover by SBI which has happened. And the second was further consolidation of the public sector banking in India. And now we'll have even bigger and lesser number of public sector banks. I thought it was a good thing to discuss this. What does it mean for public sector and economy in general? So let's get started. First, can you give us a quick breakdown of what exactly happened with Yes Bank? How did we get here?
Right. So what exactly happened was on March 5th, the RBI basically took over the board of Yes Bank. It superseded the Yes Bank board of directors. So they have now been fully in control, which is quite a rare thing to happen in the financial or even in the corporate world. But so that is the big thing that happened. Of course, share prices tanked massively. People, before RBI could put a cap on how much depositors could withdraw, which is about at 50,000 rupees. As many depositors tried to withdraw their money before that, it was just the start of a financial panic, right? So that is essentially what was happening in the financial world. I think now Yes Bank shares are something like 18 rupees or 20 rupees, this thing. So it's a massive fall from where it was. So essentially, there's a loss of confidence in Yes Bank. The RBI took over the board. And then after that, they forced SBI to buy a stake in Yes Bank. A typical arm twisting. They, you know, SBI is like the go-to slave of the government, right? So they can, you know, just crack the whip and SBI will follow suit. And they did that. So they bought, I think, about 49% stake in Yes Bank. So this is what happened. I think the interesting thing is, how did we get here? And Yes Bank is one of those, I think, an extremely ambitious bank when it started out. They spent a lot of money on their PR, on how they, you know, the brand image, that we are a quick growing company, that we, you know, we like to move fast and so on. And some of the things that they were themselves, you know, putting out in the public domain was, for example, that their credit loan advances growth rate was 334% between 2014 and 2019. Now, that is an ungodly number when it comes to a bank giving out loans.
So you're saying every year the amount of loans and advances they were giving was increasing year on year by 334%?
334%. That's massive.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So that, I think, also kind of shows that Yes Bank went on this big lending spree, that they did not probably do all of the prudential norms. They lent to a lot of people. So it's essentially, you know, Yes Bank should have said no a few times, but I think they just said yes to pretty much everyone who came forward for a loan. I mean, excuse the terrible puns, but
yeah, but for a bank's balance sheet, all these lending would reflect on the asset side, right?
Yeah, so all of the lending is on the asset side, all of the deposit is on the
so maybe side. Because they wanted to show a good picture, they went on a lending spree as well, right?
The problem is also who they lent to. So that, I mean, that's a classic problem of everyone in the banking sector, but I think Yes Bank was particularly, you know, guilty of this. So one estimate suggests that more than 25% of Yes Bank's loans were given to non-banking financial corporations, who then lent it to other, you know, companies which were not doing very well. They also lent to the power sector. They lent to, you know, real estate firms. So essentially all of the sectors which are in massive trouble in the Indian economy right now. And I think that also has caused this particular panic, because after a point of time, obviously the NPA started growing. These customers were not repaying their loans. And at one point, I think in 2018-19, if I'm not mistaken, Yes Bank's, you know, credit deposit ratio, that is the amount they've lent as against the amount they've gotten as deposit, finally exceeded 100%, which is, which means that they actually lent far more than they had deposit. So that, again, extremely bad news for a bank. That starts, you know, that's a red flag in the financial sector, if there's any. So that I think all of these things were happening. Obviously, NPA started increasing, that, you know, people who watch these things quite carefully and who were, you know, probably customers of NPA started withdrawing their deposits, which again worsened the situation for Yes Bank. That also, you know, fed into this aspect of Yes Bank's credit deposit ratio exceeding 100%. Investor confidence came down, so a lot of people who had lent, there's something called 81 bonds and so on, who had lent to Yes Bank also started withdrawing from it. Share prices of Yes Bank fell down. All of this was just in the last year. It's not something that happened over, last month or so, but this was a spectacular kind of collapse in the last one and a half years. But it was not still that sudden that warranted this kind of surprise from people. I mean, if you had watched the space, this was inevitable. I mean, this was coming. Mm. If not yesterday, it would have come today, that kind of scenario.
Right. So tell me one thing. There was a report that the capital adequacy ratio of Yes Bank was quite decent at 16.5% in March 2019, right? First of all, tell us what the CAR means and why 16.5 a reasonable number to go with. And if it was a nice number to have in March 2019, what does that say of RBI not being able to anticipate this crisis?
I think that's part of the bigger problem that not just Yes Bank is part of, but the entire financial sector is part of. So now looking back, of course, with the benefit of hindsight, it seems that that 16.5% seems completely bunkum. You know, that number.
What does it mean?
So capital adequacy ratio is basically how much capital you have. So if depositors came back and started withdrawing their money, do you have enough money to give back to the depositors, right? Mm. And that's essentially what that capital adequacy ratio means. Mm. So it's the amount of the deposits that you've set aside for such contingency, for bank runs and so on, such contingency purposes. Okay. So capital adequacy ratio of 16.5% is quite healthy. That's also going according to, you know, Basel III norms and so on.
Okay.
So that's not a bad number at all. And therefore, I think anyone who believed that number thought that Yes Bank's financials were in really good health. Mm. But in fact, if you look back now, a bank which had a capital adequacy ratio of 16.5% should have never gotten into such a position. So either something terrible went wrong, which by the way didn't. Mm. And the only other explanation is that 16.5% reported number was not true.
So that means that a private sector bank here, in this case Yes Bank, was able to probably show a number which wasn't true, an important number, and our banking regulators didn't act at that time.
Precisely. So if you look at just this example and see what went wrong, you have multiple factors. I mean, one is, of course, you have, you know, dysfunctional board of this bank. If a board allows for such numbers to be put out, then it is, you know, it's not a very good functional board. Also, the board did not have enough control of how much they lent and who they lent to and all of these aspects, right? Of course, you have poor external auditing standards. That's something that we are speaking about right now, that, you know, all of these banks are supposed to go through very strict auditing mechanisms. And that obviously has failed. There's weak corporate governance. If you look at, you know, this thing, market discipline kind of broke down because they're not able to trust some of these figures. The antitrust in the Indian financial system right now, it is quite low, and so it was even leading up to the crisis, I think. But the biggest one of all of this is the lack of a supervisory capacity, right? That the regulator, which is RBI in this case, who's, you know, given the mandate of not just controlling prices and inflation, but also on delivering on sound and good banks and banking system. So on that count, on the second part of it, at least there's a definite RBI failure, that they've not been able to supervise all of this effectively, that if they could allow a bank to post a number which is completely wrong, which is a very important financial statistic, and get away with it, I think that's a failure of the RBI standards. I mean, there are multiple other failures of RBI in this particular instance, of even when they decided to take the corrective action, how much they had to do, what they had to do and so on. But I think just allowing Yes Bank to get away with some of these things is one of the strongest kind of failures of RBI. The other one that I think you can again stress upon is that RBI has something called a prompt corrective action. It's a process that RBI has enabled since last, I think, a decade or so, because you had multiple such financial crises coming about. And RBI said that if you wait for too long for the crisis to fester, then it's going to implode, right? And therefore, we should, you know, take prompt and corrective action as soon as you start smelling trouble. And if you looked at Yes Bank's financials from 2014 to 2018-19, the signs of trouble were very much there, right? And if not, I mean, a layman like you and I might not really see it, but RBI is supposed to be tracking some of these figures. So just that exponential growth rate in loans, or the fact that they're actually lending more than their deposits should have triggered the prompt and corrective action of the RBI. But the fact that it was not done so, again, is another mistake of the RBI. Very clear-cut mistake of the RBI.
See, I think you said that the RBI's failure in regulation is also one of the factors to blame here. I think one thing we also have to realize from an institutional design perspective, the RBI is busy doing too many things. It's not an organization which has to just focus on one or two goals. It regulates payments, banking, the banking. It acts as a creditor to the government. And, you know, there are whole lot of 10 or 15 functions which RBI is doing. So part of this also reflects the fact that this institutional design of RBI is flawed. It is basically investing its energy in doing lots of things and not being able to do its core role in the process, which is actually regulate banking.
Right? Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think there's a strong case to be made that you can take away some of these roles. In fact, I was extremely happy when we went on an inflation targeting system. Now, I know a lot of people have criticized inflation targeting system, that it's almost an archaic system, etc. But the one thing that I liked, forget about all of the other mechanisms, but the one thing that I like is that finally you're giving RBI a very clear mandate of price stability, right? Say you're saying that everything else, and before, by the way, RBI had multiple things to do, not just price stability, but it also had to focus on growth, it had to focus on financial inclusion, it had to focus on MSMEs getting loans, you know, priority sector lending, etc., etc., etc. Now, at least some of those things have taken a secondary step, and price stability is put right up front. But I think you can also make a case that whether the central bank should solely be in charge of banking stability. Why can't you even divorce that role and say, let RBI look after prices? Like you have SEBI, which looks at, capital markets. Why not have another independent regulator which looks at banking, this thing? Now, that's an idea that you can actually think about further. I've not really, put a lot of thought into it, but there's no reason that the central bank should also be supervising banks. It could be a secondary level supervisor of another kind of independent regulatory authority. But it's clearly not able to do this. So you could actually divorce some of these things and make another regulatory body which has some of this capacity. So I think with RBI, capacity is not a problem, as in terms of intelligence or in terms of manpower, in terms of wisdom and so on. There's a lot of banking committee reports, etc., that's been put out. But implementation is, and part of that reason is that they're doing too many things. So you can actually start removing some of these capabilities from the RBI and giving it to others.
Yeah, just look at this instance itself. RBI first was a regulator of whatever, Yes Bank and all the private sector bank. That was one of the functions it did. It also played the function of a resolution and sort of some liquidation authority by saying that, Yes Bank, you can't withdraw and we will give finally the management, we will take it over. And finally, they also forced SBI to take this over. Right? Yeah. So in this instance itself, you see it is doing a lot more than what you would say falls under just regulating banks.
Yeah. So you could have I think our friend Amul speaks about, you could have a liquidation authority for financial sector, right? Similarly, it is pretty much similar to what the IBFC, the Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code, would do for private companies. IBC. So you could do something similar for financial sector companies, right? For essentially banks and NBFCs and so on. So if they're in trouble, I would say liquidate the company, make sure that the depositors get some part of the assets, you make sure that some of the long-term lenders, by the way, RBI screwed up on that as well, because all of the long-term lenders to Yes Bank, they've written off all of the lending. So there's something, as I said, called 81 bonds. So anyone who had invested in those 81 bonds are now written off. They don't get anything back. So basically, RBI picked winners and losers here, saying that we'll look after depositors to some extent, but not really these people who have lent to Yes Bank on a long-term basis.
What?
So, yeah, okay. Exactly. So again, that seems unfair. That's something, again, which is, I don't think RBI should be making those decisions. You could have separately some other entity which could do that. So that, I think, is part of the problem that we are speaking about, that RBI is trying to do too many things and it's not doing them really well. The other question really is about this particular solution that RBI has, bought about itself. One is, again, it had to be SBI because no one else would bail it out. But it's also too little, right? classic case of too little too late. A, if some, you know, prompt and corrective action had taken place in 2018 or early 2019, you wouldn't have reached this level of mess in the first place. You could have, even done recapitalization of Yes Bank through SBI, the same thing, but you could have done it 1 year back, not now. Right? And the effect should have been a lot better. Right now, for example, how much SBI is investing, which is 322 million rupees into Yes Bank, that is enough to cover only about 50% of Yes Bank's exposure to one client, which is Vodafone. Right? And so you have this classic case of, you know, if you want to understand the twin balance sheet problem in one scenario, I think this gives you a perfect example. You have a almost bankrupt bank lending to an almost bankrupt company. And on both sides, they're bankrupt largely because of government failures. You know, the entire AGR, not entirely because of government failures, but government failures have exacerbated the situation, right? You have the entire, you know, Supreme Court and AGR, that mess on the telecom side, and you have this entire NPA's mess on this side. You put both together and you've got this beautiful big mess.
Yeah, so. Twin balance sheet problem exacerbated by government failure,
yeah.
Right? Cool. So now let's come to this question. Given that we are in this situation already where there was a private sector bank, okay, let's say there's another bank which is in a similar situation. So how should the RBI act in that case if we are already in this state? So there are two ways, right? One, it can let the bank fail, in which case it will face a backlash from the depositors and there will be people asking that, what were you doing? The second case is actually then bail out the banks, which is being done in this case probably. But then it sends wrong incentives and signals, particularly to the economy at large, right? And there's a moral hazard problem, which means banks can fail because they know that RBI will actually finally just take care of the depositors, etc. So on the balance, which is the approach that should be taken going ahead?
This is, I think, a very, very difficult question. And I tend to have a slightly unpopular opinion, as with probably a lot of things that we discuss here. But I think it is okay to allow some banks to fail. And as I said, this was not a sudden crisis that came out of nowhere and that all of the depositors were caught unaware. Yes, the average kind of knowledge and information that an average depositor has might not be very high in this country, but still, I think there was enough kind of warning signals from nearly a year and a half back to tell that something of this sort were coming out. So, and a lot of people in the know actually withdrew their deposits from Yes Bank. So, you know, it's not that there was no information that Yes Bank was going to fail. So the people who decided to stay was, I think, largely people who were taking the risk, saying nothing would happen. And they didn't take some of these signals very strongly. And other people probably just didn't know. So there's ways to correct that as well. RBI, for example, could have slightly, you know, wrapped Yes Bank's knuckles in the open just so that sends a signal to both depositors as well as Yes Bank itself, saying get your act together, right? So in that sense, and if you've done all of that and yet there are depositors willing to stay with it for, you know, some higher returns or something, which a lot of people do even for cooperative banks, for example, right, that they give higher returns, so they decide to stay with it despite the risks. I think that's a clear choice that people are making, that it's worth the risk. So if that is the case, I think it's okay to let the bank fail because it's purely your, you know, it's a risk reward situation. So
and there are depositors insurance as
that's
well.
That's the second aspect. So there is a depositor insurance scheme. So, you know, by and large, when you look at the problem of information asymmetry, that, you know, small lenders, I mean, small depositors who don't really know too much, probably are illiterate, etc., their deposits are actually small enough to be covered under the deposit insurance scheme. So that's up to 5 lakhs now. And recently it went up from 1 lakh to 5 lakhs. And that would cover, you know, 98% of the depositors. So in that case, I mean, the small depositors. So in that case, the people who are really getting hurt are the really big depositors, but you should put the onus on them to be a bit more proactive about their own money, right? Of looking out at how the bank is doing, how the financials of the bank are, etc. So in that case, you should have let it fail. However, having said that, I will actually contradict myself now, or at least give the opposite view as well, which is that if you let a private bank fail, then I don't think you will ever have a healthy private banking system in India, because as long as public sector banks exist, and let's say you're actively allowing a private bank to fail, then every single depositor will rush to public sector banks, because there you have sovereign guarantee, here you have no sovereign guarantee, and it shows by letting it fail. Then you will have, you know, a massive crisis in the private banking sector, and I don't think it'll ever take off. So letting a private sector bank fail when you have public sector banks which have, you know, despite having worse financial record, not failing at all, I think you're sending again a wrong incentive. So if you want to allow banks to fail, you should do it in a case where you've also allowed public sector banks to fail, or that you don't have public sector banks anymore. So that's the way I
remember. Right. So that gets us to the second part about failure of public sector banks. And here we have seen a sad story, right? We had trailblazing banks, right? Syndicate Banks and Canara Bank, which were, I didn't even know until a few months ago that they were actually private enterprises, which were really trailblazing. They actually brought banking to the masses, and they were done by individuals. And then the government took them over, ran them down for over 50 years, and now it has merged both of them with each other, right? So we are in that kind of a situation, which is the second part. Now, what's to be done about them, right? So how do you regulate the public sector bank? Now, there are, the common argument that is made is you basically privatize that public sector bank. But given that we have this regulation problem where RBI is clearly not able to regulate Yes Bank, for example, if there are more public sector banks which become private, will we be able to regulate them, and will we see more of these Yes Bank kind of failures?
I think that's a very important question you've raised. While it's easy to, you know, for most of us to keep saying privatize the public sector banks, we should also realize that we do not have the state capacity to regulate private sector banks. As has been shown, I mean, if you look at just the last 1 or 2 years, there's almost a systemic kind of crisis looming at the margins, right? You had ILFS, which failed. It's not, you know, purely private entity, but you had ILFS, which failed. You had DHFL, which failed. And then you have, you know, the trouble at PNB, both, even though it's a public sector bank, now you have Yes Bank crisis. So banking crises are becoming more and more common in the last couple of years. Number of NBFCs have failed, and cooperative banks, don't even get me started on that. So that clearly shows that we have a lack of capacity in regulating general banking sectors, forget about private or public, but we have a lack of capacity in regulating the banking sector. So now privatizing more number of banks could not, you know, can lead to more trouble as well, because again, that would not have that kind of sovereign backing. Then the amount of trust in the banking system will massively go down, because as of now, at least people trust public sector banks for good, better or worse, despite them having terrible financial record. They trust the public sector banks because it has the sovereign banking. But once you remove that, I think it's going to, you know, the entire financial system could collapse on its own. But there are steps to get there, or to, you know, on the path of privatization. So first thing I think you need to do is two things parallelly. One, at least corporatize and professionalize the boards of the public sector banks. As of now, the minute you have the managing director of a bank being chosen by the finance ministry, you will always have this nexus between politicians and bank. And that's never really good for anyone. And therefore, you know, the public sector bank have been forced to, you know, lend to the businessmen friends of politicians, right? And this has been happening. Those are all NPAs. They'll never get their money back. And then that's an entire trouble. So professionalize the board, make it independent, cut down political influence. And this is not very hard to do, by the way. This is not at all hard to do. I mean, this is, you can change overnight with a stroke of the pen without any form of distortions or unintended consequences. So that's something you can do overnight. And on the long run as well, try and reduce RBI's interference in the lending patterns of the public sector banks. So don't run every government scheme through the public sector banks. You know, from all kinds of, you know, government schemes are run through the public sector banks, and therefore they don't have the capacity to look at other things, right, which they're supposed to be doing, which is lending and borrowing. And so that is basically reducing government interference in banks, RBI's interference in these banks, and finally, of course, the worst of the lot, politicians' interference in these banks. You know, remove all of that. Simultaneously, I think you need to increase capacity of RBI in terms of the regulatory capacity of regulating these banks, right? Mm. So have good standards, have good tests of when banks are doing well, when banks are not doing well. And by the way, it doesn't need to reinvent the wheel on any of these counts. It's all out there. For example, I mean, there's Basel III norms will give you very detailed measures of when, you know, what is the adequacy ratio, etc., that is required.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a very difficult thing to do even from a government point of view, in the sense that when there are high transactions, high discretion, etc., that time things are very difficult. So, for example, if you have to actually, a government has to do things like teaching in a school and improving learning outcomes, is a tough thing to do because millions of people are involved, transactions are so many, discretion is there at the hands of the teachers, etc. But here, you have to just talk to what, 30-40 banks?
Yeah.
And basically, 10 smart people should be able to come up with a way So it is not a really wicked problem in that sense.
Exactly. So you could, and this is not really tough to do. If you look at the amount of, as I said, the amount of interference for the public sector banks, they're just not allowed to do what, you know, a bank is supposed to be doing. So reducing that and then improving regulatory capacity of RBI is important. Mm. Second step would be to allow to truly reduce the entry barriers for private players in this financial sector. Right. So as of now, the entry barriers are quite high. The RBI has a very, very tight whip over who can have a commercial banking license and who cannot. And then there's a second rung called payment bank licenses, which also is given out by RBI extremely selectively. I think they have to, you know, be a bit more open and lenient for these things. You set up few standards, and as long as anyone meets those criteria or standards, I think they, you could give up a license. Mm. That's the second bit. And finally, I think you can privatize banks as the third step. Mm. Privatize a lot of these public sector banks. Merging is not ideal at all. Merging is not a solution. Mm. I've been saying this. I think it's copping out on the true solution. Mm. Because when you merge two balance sheets, the weaker of the two balance sheets become more dominant. Mm. Right? Because all of the endemic systemic problems which are there about the, all the NPAs, it just grows to the larger bank as well. So you're in fact creating a bigger mess by merging banks. That's not a solution. Mm. But you can, once you've done the first two steps, I think you can go ahead and actually privatize the banks.
That's right. So I think we'll end with this. The main lessons being that this is a failure of a private sector bank, but it is as much a failure of banking regulation in India. And we discussed a few ways in which this can be fixed going ahead. So thanks, Anubhav. Thanks for this.
Thanks, Pranay.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at takshashilainst or our website takshashila.org.in.